Emily White, what did Jung say about dreams? I'm Emily White from Minneapolis. I'm a psychotherapist, and I've been a Jungian for over 20 years, and I've collected my own dreams for over 20 years. And here at Holden, I have sometimes very wild dreams, and sometimes not so wild. Everybody dreams every night, but we don't remember all our dreams, and we have to make an effort. However, after I give this talk, I hope you'll realize why dreams are really important and that it's not just something that you can dismiss. There's an old Arab proverb that says, tell me what a man dreams and I'll tell you who he is. Jung phrased it this way. He said, dreams are the royal road to the unconscious. Now, why is that important? Can't I do my business without paying attention to dreams? Well, of course. For the outer world, we don't really need dreams all that much. But our whole being is not just the conscious part, which is just like the tip of the iceberg. Four-fifths is underwater, so to speak. It is the unconscious, and Jung called it the collective unconscious. The collective unconscious is that all that part which is not knowable except through dreams, and the dream is like a mirror. So it's as though you went to the doctor and with a broken leg and said, tell me, is the leg broken? He says, we need an x-ray. You say, oh, I don't think I need an x-ray. Can't you tell from the outside? So if a person comes to me and doesn't bring any dreams, I can deal with it, but I can't get underneath. I don't know what's really happening. Dreams also are guides. I will talk about that more on Thursday, I guess. And the archetypes that I mentioned are like instincts that are embedded in the unconscious and form complexes. You've heard of inferiority complex? There's a mother complex, a father complex, an Oedipus complex, you name it. And when you get emotionally upset, it's usually that a complex is hooked, it is in the unconscious, and that comes out in dreams, and that's again where you can find out a lot about how to help a person by looking at the dream and the dream content. Contrary to Freud, Jung did not have fixed symbols, and he certainly did not say that everything in the unconscious is sex. So a cave is not the womb, and a tower is not a phallus, but it's an individual symbol that has to fit you. So sometime during the week we'll have some dream sharing, and I'll sort of walk through a dream with you and help you understand what the symbol means for you as an individual. And you make the association. Now, if you dream of Aunt Emma, then I'll ask you what Aunt Emma meant and anything else. And if you dream of somebody you don't know, that may be an archetypal symbol. It might be an archetype rising. We'll talk more about that later. All right, Jung said it's the royal road to the unconscious. Another way of saying it is that it is the key that unlocks the mystery of the unconscious. And it is the best way to understand what the psyche is all about. There are many symbols that will rise in your dreams, and I will talk about some of them next Thursday and some on Saturday. I've just mentioned them briefly now. Archetypes, which are like instincts. You know, animals have instincts and they know just what to do. So we have archetypes that we have inherited from the whole humanity, so that the great mother, the great father, the wise old man, the wise old woman, they're all archetypes that appear in dreams, but clothed in your century, in your culture, and in your individual life. So that the great mother to an Indian might appear differently than to you. The great mother might appear differently, of course, to a man of the 19th century than it would to a person today. Now, to show you how important dreams are for Jung himself, this book, which is in the library, it's the paperback, Man and His Symbols. I recommend it highly because you'll see that it's the only book he wrote that is understandable to the by the layman. Layperson. He was interviewed by John Freeman from the BBC, and he was asked, would you please write a book that ordinary people can understand? Jung was 84. In fact, he died near his 86th birthday. No, he said, I have written 20 volumes. Go to those. Everything I have to say is in those 20 volumes. And he really does have 20 volumes of thorough, esoteric, Germanic English. They're now translated. Very hard to understand, even for professionals. So Freeman went away, and Jung had a dream. And this is Jung's dream. He was out on a platform, I guess, and was addressing blue-collar workers. And he was explaining his theories to them, and they all clapped, and they understood him. So when he woke from that dream, he ran to the phone, well, walked to the phone, called John Freeman and said, I had a dream, and yes, I will write the book. See, because he felt that this was a call to write a book that would be understood by the layman. So he wrote the introduction, and three of his close followers wrote the other chapters. I'll just read the contents for you. And he completed this work 10 days before he died, which I thought was beautiful. Part one by Jung himself is called Approaching the Unconscious. Part two by Henderson, who is his colleague, Ancient Myths and Modern Man. And Jung was very interested in mythology, and again, in myths we have the same symbols appear as in dreams. Fairy tales and myths contain all the same symbols as we find in dreams. So he once said that mythology is the dream of a culture. Then the third part is Marie-Louise von Franz, The Process of Individuation, and I will talk about that as well. That's the process of growing. Part four, Aniela Jaffe, Symbolism in the Visual Arts. I'll talk about that when I talk about symbols. And part five, which is intriguing but different, Yolanda Jacoby, Symbols in an Individual Analysis. Now, as she says in that chapter, there is no typical Jungian analysis. Again, the difference between Jung and Freud is that the client or the patient and the therapist sit face to face, and he sees them, you see them once a week, and you start where the patient comes in with whatever problem, and you try to work forward. If the dream brings up something from childhood, you go back. The Freudian approach is lying on the couch and going daily and free associating, beginning with earliest childhood and just going systematically through childhood memories. And I think there's value for that, but A, the expense, and sometimes irrelevant material, because not every person has had traumas in oral or anal or sexual areas, but they go through all three systematically. Most of us had some problems, but maybe they're solved. For Jung, it means start here with the real problem that the person comes in and work backwards as it is relevant. Similarly, with the dream symbols, find out what really clicks for the person. Many times, and I do this with my clients, I analyze a dream and there's something he or she says that associates something very strongly for me, and I say, aha! But I hold back and I say, what does it mean for you? Because what it means for me may not be what it means for the other person. Then after they have said everything, I say, could it also mean this? My idea, you see? But you don't impose any meaning on the person. Jung said himself that he tries to come into the analytic hour as innocent as a babe, or as though he knew nothing. And he never tried to give advice. I mean, that's very bad form in therapy anyhow. You don't give advice. You help the person to see what is necessary to do. You lead them kind of gently. I think Jesus leads us in the same way. He shows us the way. He says, I am the way. But he never breaks down the door. You have to open it. It's similar. Same, very similar. Okay, so did I say that? Did I tell you about Jung himself? He was a Swiss psychiatrist who studied schizophrenia and word association, and he coined terms like extroversion and introversion, which you've all heard. We'll have a session on that later in the week. And he was a very versatile man. He lived by the water, the Lake Geneva, and he built his house, a part of his house, a round tower, something like this, out of stone, carved in stone, and carved over his door a saying, whether we call on God or not, he is present. He also was a gourmet cook, loved to chop wood and see some wood, and sometimes he said he had the best thoughts while chopping wood. So he was not just an intellectual. I have another book where on one side he's shown as the earthy man that he is, sitting by the water, and on the other side he's the scholar that we know. He had integrated both sides of himself. And he urges all people, especially those who come for analysis, to learn to integrate all aspects of their self into a harmonious whole. So that's the task. And that's where dreams are important. Now, how do we remember dreams? Well, I think it's easy if we set our mind to remembering them and if we feel that they're of value. Not all dreams are big dreams. Some dreams are just processing what you went through in the day. Some dreams are so big that you don't have to write them down. You'll remember them always. And repetitive dreams are those where you haven't solved the problem. It just keeps coming up and coming up and coming up. If you need to know something, I'm sure the unconscious will throw you a dream. And if you pay attention to it, you will get some wisdom out of it. Because why would the Bible contain so many dreams in which God gives direction to his leaders, to his people? You all know the many big dreams, the Jacob's ladder, and the dream where Joseph is told to espouse Mary. Any other dreams you can?
Daniel.
Dream. Yes. Joseph interpreting dreams to Pharaoh. Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Yeah. So I think there's a book at the bookstore, which I didn't write down, by Morton Kelsey. Dream, God Speaks Through Dreams, something like that. I think he still does today. I think the Holy Spirit does speak to us. And I will give it a twist that Jung did, that through the archetype of the wise old man or the wise old woman. And that can be a teacher, it can be a minister, can be the analyst if you're going through analysis. So when we come to our discussion, we can talk about that some more. Any questions?
If you're having a dream and you wake up and you like that dream, continue, could you go back to sleep and continue the dream?
Some people could do that, yes.
Mm-hmm. My brother does.
Yeah.
And his sister does.
Sometimes you do it when you don't want to.
That's true. Yeah.
Sometimes you're relieved when the dream is over.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, nightmares are not pleasant, and they take various forms, but many of them are warnings, yes?
Is it true that a series of dreams carrying out a same theme is more meaningful than just, say, a single one?
Yes, I think that means that there's really a message or something that you should pay attention to. And in my own case, now that I've looked at 20 years of dreams, I can sort of see a thread going through it. It's quite fascinating. And it took me many, many years to listen to one that I would like to share with you and have shared before. I am a good student and I have many gifts, but the kitchen and cooking is not one of my gifts. And I would go in there, hunch my shoulders, angry, and so forth. So I had this dream. And my priest came over and took my hand in a circle and said, you have to work with love and thanksgiving. Without anger is not enough. Oh, that's easy. So I went in there and I scrubbed like this. It wasn't that. It took me 10 years. I think I'm there now. But it took a long time to really get it into my behavior. But it was so clear. That dream was so beautiful.
In the dream that your priest said.
Yeah. He actually took my hand.
How many times did he say it?
Well, he just said it once. Oh. Yeah. I had other similar dreams. This is the key dream. I had many dreams where he was giving me all sorts of advice. He is in my dreams the wise old man, so he isn't so old. But
is there a way of aiding one to recall their dreams? Or do all people dream?
Everybody dreams. When you have your rapid eye movements, you dream 3 or 4 times a night. And if you have said to yourself, I will try to remember the dreams, the early morning dream is most easily remembered. And especially, this sounds awfully silly, but let's say you get up around 5 or so and go to the bathroom and then go back to sleep. Then you might have a dream that you most readily remember. And if you have your pen and pencil at your bedside, and most importantly, to keep your eyes closed and say, I want to remember my dream, instead of opening your eyes and saying, now let's see, we're holding in there 6, 7 things we want to do today. You see, the moment you jump right out into the world, it's wiped away. It's sort of like wiping it off the board, you know. You have to train yourself, and it'll rise, it'll be there. And you'd be surprised, as you start writing the dream, more will come. That happened to me this morning. I thought I remembered this much, and I actually had that much of a dream. Another very important thing is that if you don't dream, it has nothing to do whether you remember it or not, if you are deprived of dream sleep, you become psychotic after a while. We talked about that last time. They wake in the lab, they will wake people up when they see the eye movements. And if they do that too long, the person gets totally disoriented. And in the hospital, Eileen was telling me, she's a nurse, people are awakened to be given medical medicine and blood pressure, and they get very disoriented. It's more than their sickness. Yeah?
If I may share, we had one woman in critical care. We had a series of heart attacks, but she'd never been without oxygen. She was acting as though her brain were dead, and her electroencephalogram, her brain waves, were erratic. And so they decided to take her off the ventilator after 2 months of no response from her. But her mother said to me, I'm just not ready to have her taken off the ventilator. So I went to the doctors, and they were real mad and everything, but we decided to leave her on the ventilator. Then 2 weeks, we gave her antipsychotic medication, and she came out of it, and she was clear as bell. She was just psychotic from being woken up so much, and all the environment around her that was so unusual. Mm-hmm.
What if we set ourselves to remember dreams, and we go home now, and we have several that really frighten us? How do we handle that?
Well, if they frighten you badly enough, I suppose you talk to somebody who knows about dreams. If not, you try to apply what you've learned here.
Did you say that there would always be a seed of hope?
I was saying that last week. That most dreams that have a lot of conflict in them also have part of the solution and a lot of hope in them. That's part of what I've learned to see, and that Jung points out, that the conflict already has points towards the solution. And we may have specific examples. I could show you how that works. Yes?
What of dreaming? It seems that over a period of years, every once in a while a dream crops up where I don't quite make it there in time.
Yes.
Is that...
But it's very common.
You know, and I don't think I'm that kind of a person. I'm always late, but in the dreams I am.
Yeah. Well, there's several possibilities, but it's a very common one. When you have something to do that does cause you some anxiety, there's this, I'll not make it, the fear of not making it on time. In reality, you make it. But the fear is what is see is in the unconscious, you see. And if it's just, you know, it's a normal kind of anxiety, we all have that. I'll give you a very good example. My daughter got married the end of May, and she lives on a farm in Wisconsin. We live in Minneapolis. And the ceremony was going to be yet at another place in Wisconsin. So there were maps drawn and people to be gotten here and food to be transported. For weeks before, I was dreaming of somebody picking us up. I didn't know where we were going, how we were connecting, endlessly. And I wake up with this, where was I supposed to go? You know, there was just this continued anxiety, how would we get there? It all worked out fine, but I had quite a bit of anxiety about it. And it was a repetitive
thing. So you're saying that one had better have a look at a bit of anxiety if that comes up too often.
Yeah, that's right.
Did you have a dream that, that say, you were bodily flying through the air and this reminded you, say, of years ago when you saw a scene like myself, if I were up in a mountain and I saw an eagle or a hawk floating through the air, and I said, boy, if I could only do that. Now, would that desire bring a dream on like this?
I can't say if that desire could bring the dream on, but the fact that you dreamt of flying is significant in itself. It's a very, it's another common dream. We all want to rise above the situation. We have this urge. We've finally got an airplane that'll drive, that'll fly us places. But we still have the urge to fly, and you all know the story of Icarus who flew too close to the sun. You know that? And then he fell. We have this great desire to be able to fly with our own wings. And in dreams, we often do this. It means different things for different people. It's very pleasant, I'll be with you, very pleasant to float, and it usually means that you can rise above the situation. It's a general thing. Specifically, it may mean something else. But it's kind of fun. Yeah?
When these dreams are repeated, then, my husband would, before he passed away, would dream, oh, just real often that he would be flying.
Mm-hmm.
When they're repeated, what does that happen?
How did it end? Did he
woke up before he landed any place.
Well, I can't say except that when a dream is repeated, it is to be paid attention to. It has importance.
Anxiety, though, is not always bad. His anxiety is actually what got him there on time. I probably should have a little more of that. But I think if you dream something or you're anxious about it, it can just be an indicator that you are. Say if something has happened to your children or something, or see them have an accident, or you see them. Now, these are common anxiety things, are they not? They don't always indicate something that's going to happen.
No. Having a prophetic dream, which is what you're implying, that you dream of an accident will really happen, is very, very rare, and is usually when you already have the gift of having extrasensory perception, then in dreams you will probably also see what happens. Sometimes, however, you dream of something happening, and something very similar happens. It's called synchronicity, two things happening at the same time, and that kind of startles you. But it's just a coincidence that's extraordinary. Anxiety in itself is not bad. In fact, anxiety is kind of the steam that makes the locomotive move. Too much anxiety is bad, you know, moderation and everything, basically.
Will you say some more about ESP?
Okay. ESP is extrasensory perception, as we know. We could see ahead. It's almost as though we could look around corners. These people are usually very intuitive, which is a trait that people have. Some people have. And they may have the ability to foretell the future or to... what's the other one? Influence the environment. It is a gift, sort of like musical ability. It's fairly rare, but it is very... A medium has extrasensory perception, a person who will sit in a seance. I think it's hard for a Christian to take it too seriously, because I think it makes for a kind of pride. And I think somewhere it says in the Bible we should examine the spirits, because sometimes the occult can be an avenue for evil spirits to work. So you have to be very careful.
But it isn't to say that God doesn't act that way.
No,
too, and sometimes in
prophets. Prophets were certainly
twice
people.
In a lifetime of some persons.
Right.
You know?
Prophets certainly had ESP. I mean, that's what they were, prophets. But they were given this gift by the Holy Spirit. So I think...
But there are some spirit giving.
I would think so.
Yeah,
I mean, that's where the danger comes in.
Is there an ebb and flow to that gift?
Yeah, I think so. Oh, yeah, definitely. Kathleen?
I didn't say anything about meditation. And I think Christians are often worried about letting evil spirits get into any kind of meditation you might want to try. Mm-hmm. Or even in dreams.
Well, I think... I want to say again, I think dreams you don't have to be afraid of, because I think God spoke through dreams and continues to speak through dreams, or the Holy Spirit, whatever. I mean, I do think that meditation, which is a conscious emptying of the self to get come inward, is a very useful thing and can be combined and is part of prayer. But it is often associated with non-Christian beliefs and then regarded as dangerous. I personally meditate every morning and pray every morning. It's sort of the prelude to prayer. It's a way of emptying my brain of all the worries and fears and attachments and letting God speak to me, kind of.
It's kind of, if you empty the house, then fill it with the presence of God.
Yes.
But if you empty it and do not fill it, the legions can
come in. Exactly,
Jesus
exactly.
Name.
Yes. Yeah. That's what the danger is, that you have to then allow God to fill it. Yes?
So you think that God will honor our intentions when we...
Yes, definitely.
This might be a little off the subject, but what about something like a trance or like being...
It's related, but that is where you... Oh, the question, pardon me, was a trance or being hypnotized, how does that relate to what we're talking about? Being hypnotized, you put yourself under the power of another person who takes over your consciousness and speaks directly to your unconscious, personal unconscious. I'm a little wary of hypnotism. It has to be a very skilled person who will then not leave you in their power, but will cut it off with a post-hypnotic suggestion. And trance has to do with this, with the ESP and with a special kind of personality, and it's related to schizophrenia, where one part of the person doesn't know what the other part does. But it may be a very useful thing if it is not abused. That is trances. So I really, it's not exactly related to what we're talking about. But, back to dreams, yes? Anybody?
Well, there is what such a thing as hypnotizing oneself. That's more related to meditation than, is it?
Yeah, I think repeating a formula or a prayer is really a form of self-hypnosis, if you want to call it that. I prefer not to call it that, that's all. About the same. Yeah? Okay. Did you have a question? No? Yeah. Oh, I thought you did.
I guess I'm wondering about expressing anger through dreams.
Oh, boy. Very useful, very helpful. You might be surprised, as I was. I love my husband dearly. The amount of anger I expressed in my dreams towards him. I mean, gee, he was even cursed in one of my dreams. It's a good place to ventilate all your feelings, and that's why it's so useful. If you cannot accept it, let's say you dream of some violent attack on a person that's close to you, and it really shakes you up, It means probably you've repressed this anger so much that you can't deal with it. We all have these angry, hateful feelings sometimes towards those people we love the most. Because there's both sides, and dreams may often contain a lot of hostility and anger and even murder. I'd like to say a word about death, dreams of death. If you dream that somebody dies, or part of you, or somebody, or you're dying, it doesn't mean that you're going to die, but rather that something in you needs to die off before something new can grow. Just like if you look at the leaves now, they'll be turning and falling, but the new buds are there. The old leaves have to fall off before we can have a new growth, you see. And of course those things are scary, but again, what I do with my clients is to teach them to look at their dreams so that they begin to understand what they mean, and they will then come in and say, this is the dream I had, and this is what I think it means, and then I'll add a few things, you see, so that after a while they're able to look at them and by themselves. Yeah?
I dream often about Christ's return, and I'm just so terrified, not for myself, but for my loved ones, that I feel in these dreams I will think, oh, just give me one more day, you know, to reach that person, and yet when I'm awake, when you don't know how to go about.
When he returns, is it terrifying? Is he?
No. But it's just the
finality of it.
Expectation that it's going to happen.
And you feel some of your family is not prepared or doesn't believe. Yeah. Yes.
And it's so terrifying.
Well, maybe it could motivate you to find ways and means to reach them. I think we have to constantly throw out the seed like a good sower, constantly. And after you've sown out the seed, it's no more your problem. See, you're not responsible for their soul. I had to learn that the hard way. But you have to keep throwing out the seed. And if it falls on barren ground, that's not your problem. But it is your responsibility to keep throwing out the seed.
One of the things that's helpful with that kind of feeling is to know that God loves them and is trying to win them a lot more than you are. You know, and if He has that kind of concern for our loved ones, then certainly we can entrust them to His kids. But it is a fear, like your kids getting hurt in an accident. It's the same thing.
Yes.
If you have a dream, let's say 2 years ago I had a dream about something, and I just realized that this summer it came true, would that influence your subconscious to perform an act? Like, I dreamt 2 years ago that I was working in a post office and I sent a letter to a friend that I hadn't thought of for 3 years. Mm-hmm. This summer I'm working in a post office on staff and I sent a letter very unpredictably to a friend who really needed that letter. I wonder if that dream 2 years ago influenced my subconscious to send that letter.
I think the reverse, your unconscious influence, yeah, that's what you're saying, your consciousness to do that.
She really needed that letter. She wrote it. I sent it kind of incidentally, and she just clung on to it.
Well, see, this is, I think that's where you see the mystery of how God works through everyone, and especially through dreams.
I didn't remember about that dream till
today. You didn't remember it till today, till after you've done it.
Yeah.
Well, you see, that's what unconscious means. You were not aware until you did it.
Yeah. So I remember 2 years ago thinking, I dreamt the funniest thing today. I was working in the post office. I'm a nurse. What am I ever going to do in the post office?
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm finding as I look back at my dreams over the years, that many years earlier I dreamt something that indeed I'm doing that seemed totally unlikely. And they're not prophetic. It's just that if it falls on good soil, and I mean, it's not now like the Word of God, but if this is something you're meant to do, then your dream will anticipate what you're doing. That's what I mean by knowing the solution before you are conscious of it. See? Now, one other thing I think I mentioned here, anima, animus and shadow, I'd like to talk about. First, the shadow. The shadow is that part of your psyche that you don't like, can't accept, that trips you up, that's despicable. It's that part which, as Christians, we have great trouble owning, and we like to put all of it on the devil. The devil made me do it. I'm not so sure the devil made you do it. I think it's the devil inside you that made you do it. Accepting your own shadow is the first task of becoming whole or going, accepting yourself. And in therapy, it's the first thing we try to do, to recognize the shadow, to make it conscious, and then have you accept it so that you could say, okay, I know you're there, but just now, don't bother me. Whereas if you say, oh, I'm just so wonderful, then the little devils will sit on your shoulder and trip you up for sure. I'll give you a funny example. The other night, after I read the gospel, and people were coming to me, and I felt just wonderful, and it was a beautiful service. And I came home and I said, well, I'm going to hold on to this. I'm not going to write my letter till tomorrow telling about all this. So in the morning I got up and carefully sat down and wrote the letter, boasting how well I was doing. You know what happened? I put the carbon in the wrong way. So that's those things, that's what I mean. These are little trivial things, but that's an example of how to teach you. So the shadow is something you should become aware of. Anima and animus are terms that Jung coined that are very important, because anima means the feminine aspect in a man, and animus is the masculine aspect in women. And they are somewhat conscious. They're not totally unconscious. You can be aware of your feminine side or your masculine side. In our culture today, women are encouraged to express this side, to be ambitious, to be go-getters, to be assertive. And men are not finding it shameful to dandle the baby and give it the bottle and be nurturing. So I think there is a good time where this balance is coming to the fore. In the past, in your generation more, women had to do all the nurturing and repress their masculine side at some detriment if they were married. See, they couldn't combine marriage with expressing the masculine side. There were people, career women, but then they wouldn't be married. And the men, of course, were out there, and I'm sure none of the men here have ever really changed diapers or done any of that. It just was not to be done. Yes? Yeah. Well, it is important to recognize this, but it's one. The reason I brought it up here is not so much to talk about feminine liberation or whatever, but to point out that when we fall in love, we project this perfect image. The man projects his anima image that he carries around in his breast onto this woman. And if it fits, he's in seventh heaven, he's in love. Similarly, the woman carries the animus image, she finds the man, she projects it onto him, and it fits, and they're in love. And they get along and for whatever the honeymoon period is, and suddenly one day, whether it's after marriage or before marriage, whatever, they wake up and suddenly it's Joe Bloke and Jane. And it's not at all the image, it doesn't fit. And that's that first falling out that is the recognition that this is an individual and that you have projected an ideal. And somehow you have to bring the two together and work it through, and that's the whole task then of marriage. And sometimes indeed it's necessary to part because the image doesn't fit at all. And it's that great disillusionment that I'm sure we've all experienced in one form or another. But if you become aware that we always will project this image because it's somewhat unconscious, and look for this person whom this image will fit, the anima or animus, then when you take back the projection and you see the real person, then a true relationship can begin. Then John, Joe, and Jane can really speak to each other. It's not the animus and anima talking to each other, you see. But that's always there in the background. It's sort of like a, I don't know what the image would be, but it's always sitting there.
Is this image that I would project related to the male part of me?
Yes.
Anyway, it is. Oh.
Yes.
My own personal.
But where you get it from, that varies. And that gets too complicated. But some of that image comes from people you admire, role models. Let's say the girl gets it partly from her father, and especially if it's a good father. And that's why women often marry men who are similar to their father, vice versa. Men marry women who are similar to their mother. But if they're looking for a mother, then they're in for trouble, you see, because a wife is not the mother. And that's another area of great... that's a projection of the mother image onto the woman rather than the anima. Those things can all be worked through. They're not terrible. But just being aware that you've projected something from within that has nothing to do with the real person out there. And it's a big shock when you wake up one morning. I'm sure how too many people has that happened. You suddenly wake up and you see that that person is not this idealized image. So you see the usefulness of what Jung talked about, anima and animus.
I've got a question about intercessory prayer that may have, that ties in a little bit with what we were saying about dreams being the way God can talk to us at times. Our six-year-old, after we had left a former parish, had, we'd been gone maybe 4 years. And all of a sudden, when she was, maybe she was four when we left 2 years, and she was in first grade at this point. And she all of a sudden dreamt about this old man that had been the Justice of Peace in town. Now, she had only passing contact with him and he had talked to her and greeted her, but she dreamt that he was in trouble and needed help.
Mm-hmm.
And as we were praying prayers that night, this had come to her, that she had dreamt this. And evidently, she had just all of a sudden said, "Dear God, bless Mr. So-and-so." And that's, you know, like 2 or 3 years after we had been there.
Mm-hmm.
And out of the clear blue, no one had talked about him or anything. And I went in and said to my husband, "This man must be needing our prayers at this point." You know, so we prayed for him, of course. But it was about 2 weeks later that a doctor from that town came to visit and said that this man had been run out of town. And he had been, you know, accused of doing something that he felt that he had not done, of course.
Mm.
But there had been a real traumatic time in that man's life.
Mm.
And a little girl had been the one, you know, that this had come through. Now, what place does intercessory prayer hold?
I can't answer that part. I can only say that the dream is sort of like a radar receptor, and some people are more sensitive, and she may just have picked up his need. How this happens is a mystery. I don't know, but dreams often make you more open and more sensitive to somebody's need. And then when you were praying, it came up. How that happened, I don't know either. But apparently there was a connection. It would be kind of interesting to expand on that.
One of the questions I'm going to ask God, how do you use intercessory?
Yeah.
Does that influence you, or does it make us more receptive to opportunities to, or is there a support that can travel over the miles?
Well, I mean, I believe implicitly in prayer, and I think that we all should pray, what is the word? Constantly, do we? I hope so. Especially for peace these days. I believe, while we're on the subject, that this is the only thing that will save our world if we really pray fervently, constantly, and without doubt, that peace will be possible. Because we can't go out there and stop the bomb. I'd love to go out there and dismantle a few, but I'm not ready to go to jail. But we can pray. And in the bookstore, I'd like you to notice there's a word, peace prayer, on a postcard. And it would be a good postcard to send. They don't need to see Holden. It would be nice if you would use up every last postcard in the bookstore. And more than that, pray fervently, frequently, without ceasing. We have about 10 more minutes.
I need a definition of collective unconscious.
Oh, yeah, okay. That's the phrase that caused Jung to break with Freud. He was his disciple for about 6 years. Collective unconscious means that it is the unconscious that contains, like an ocean contains the fish, contains the archetypes, the collective images that humanity has carried throughout the ages. The great mother, the wise old man, the hero, the dragon, the serpent, the wise old woman, the mother. Okay? The collective unconscious is the unconscious that contains the archetypes. And they go together. And it's Jung's contribution to psychological theory, which is very well expressed in this book, incidentally, which is by a Jungian analyst in Minneapolis. As I said on the board, I take orders for this, whereas the other one is in the bookstore. The collective unconscious is that which made Jung break with Freud, because Freud maintained that there's only a personal unconscious, and that all of the force in this unconscious is either sex or death, either a sex wish or a death wish, which Jung felt was too limiting. He felt that the unconscious contains creative energy and is much broader than just a personal unconscious. It's like mythology, you see. And there's a term, psychic energy, I will be using. The unconscious is the storehouse of psychic energy, the place where it's transformed so it's usable. And your conscious ego is just a little tip of an iceberg, as I said to begin with. And as we talk through the week, you'll probably become more aware of your own unconscious. The other day I was talking and I made a Jungian slip. I said Freud instead of Jung. And about Freudian slips where something comes out that you didn't intend to say. That's from the unconscious. Well, we have time for two more questions. Yeah?
You mentioned earlier today about the fact that a nightmare could be a warning. Could you give an example of that?
Well, a nightmare is usually so frightening that it wakes you up, and because it's frightening, it usually contains a lot of anxiety, and depending on the specific kind of nightmare, you see, that's why it's a warning. Yeah?
I dream an awful lot, remember quite a bit of it. Somebody said if you eat a lot of sweets before you go to bed, it'll make you dream.
Or pickles, or pizza.
Ice cream.
Ice cream. Yeah. I don't know. My husband and I have tried everything. I don't really know if there's anything that you eat that makes a difference, though. It's a popular conception, idea. Yeah, one more.
How long does a dream last? Like one time, I was traveling with my grandparents, and my grandfather came and tapped me on the head to wake me up, and my whole dream revolved around that tap.
Yeah, well, you see, time has no meaning in dreams, none whatsoever. Before and after, I sometimes think it's a looking glass world. I think that what comes first is last. Time has no meaning in dreams, and in that tapping moment, you may dream of a long period of time. Most dreams are 5 or 10 minutes, but you know you can dream that years passed, or months, or whatever. You can also have different scenes, you know, like you were here and you were there, and so forth.
There's no logic to dreams, usually.
No logic whatsoever. And that's why they're sort of scary, and we can't deal with them in our waking lives. But that's precisely the balance that we need when we are very rational and very here and now oriented, you see. It's that other dimension. Now, I want one word of warning. There are people who are so attuned to the unconscious, as they are so overwhelmed by the material, that they lose their rationality. Then we call them insane, you see. That's what happens when all of this, like in the volcano, when he was talking about all this lava comes up. The ego has a great place, and I'm not saying that we should let our dream world determine our lives, but we should listen to it because it can guide us. Okay? I'd like to let everybody get in line for supper, but people can stay and we'll talk. Okay? Thank you very much.
Rather, last week, I think just as I'm going to see, I see a scene.